Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about the psychology of, I suppose, general relativity and sort of the weird sort of psychological aspect of what happens once you gain a certain level of understanding and some of the scientific principles become not just equations, but you begin to know them. And I suppose what I can sort of describe is sort of a change of feeling. Sort of so initially you had just sort of your closed Euclidean world, your local world, the distance to your horizon, that type of stuff, and then you had the sort of, I suppose, the feeling of awe and distance and greatness as the scale of the universe got into you and different phenomena that you couldn't understand, especially when you were encountering new thing after new thing. And now I'm on to this sort of a new area where I'm actually feeling a little bit claustrophobic. I don't know, the sameness, the size of the universe, the sameness of the universe, and what's inside the universe. It's sort of like, like that's it. The universe is it. I know that sounds weird and strange. There's a claustrophobia, and I'll talk a bit about that. And that's sort of that there's only so many concepts, and then after that there's nothing. It's really, really nothing to go with. There's that, and then also the realization that a good fraction of the reason why you had this feeling of infinite is that there is an aspect of someone really not understanding what they're teaching and explaining leaves a gap and leaves you with that sense of infinite. So rather than just saying, oh, look, I really don't understand this, they sort of wave their hands and they sort of tell you how to do something towards the end of the exam without actually explaining it. So you get this this embedded mistake. So you sort of leap over one thing, you get some viewpoint, and you can't actually see where that's come from. See if I can explain it for a little bit. Now, to be quite brutally honest, I'm just going through with my computer. Let's go two things. I'm feeding the mosquitoes out here, and the second thing is that I'm taking off the trackers, doing a virus scan of my computer, which is going awesomely slow, and I suppose there's certain things I've done for my computer to do things in background so I can do my executive stuff quickly and then leave it for a couple of hours if necessary to process videos or upload it in its own time. And it, rather than having me to check on it all the time, it sort of automatically goes there. And now I'm going through a new regime of doing video editing, and you have to actually make it sufficiently of a certain standard, and that takes up a huge amount of computer time. And it's sort of now that I say, oh yeah, perhaps I need eventually to get a faster computer. So in the meantime, you don't have a lot of headroom, and you have to check up for if you browse for any length of time, you pick up trackers. I don't know quite how I do it. I don't browse advertised things. I just browse information. You pick up trackers and stuff like that. There's trackers, and it's going through virus scan, and the virus boot time virus scan takes I don't know, forever. So I'm out here, and I was just trying to capture this feeling that I've sort of understood a sort of a higher level of, from a special relativity back to the normal universe and the gap that's been there, and then I've begun to understand general relativity and tenses and complex numbers. And when I say complex numbers, really complex numbers, that's tenses. I think there's six ranks tenses to explain what's going on. And I'm beginning to get a bigger understanding of that. But then there's electromagnetic radiation, quantum physics, electromagnetic radiation. I'm beginning to understand the vector potentials, and some of the complex maths is melting away. Like, I would know how to compute it, but I wouldn't actually understand exactly what it's doing. Or I'd know some theorems, but the theorems wouldn't be just really a good theorem is the statement of the obvious from another way. It's sort of like, it's sort of a good theorem sort of guides you to the theorem. So this is the Stokes theorem, various things like that. That sort of guides you to go forward. Then eventually, as you come along, you go, oh, is that it? So there's certain things which are basically stuck in the universe that you really can't get around. And one of them is causality. Causality is one thing that something can't cause. Once something's in the past, it's definitely in the past. I think that might be one example of what causality is. You can't time travel into the past or anything like that. So, and causality is to do with the fact that with the speed of light, and the speed of light, we're in a space, and it's sort of, you know, with the flip side of the coin of causality is this, you know, things travel at the speed of light, and we're only in one space. There's sort of two outs of it. First is, you could travel faster than the speed of light and be in our space, or you could travel at the speed of light and our space be weirdly connected. You could, in effect, create infinite energy there. You could violate. So there's a whole sort of fabric of space with causality, the speed of light, and the properties of space which allow a speed of light to keep on going. So causality is like, you could, if you're perhaps a woman, you could go back and have more babies, you know, and sort of just have an infinite number of babies, and I don't know quite. You could, I was trying to think of an example there. So there's a whole series of phenomena which come out. And then you have, I suppose, these things to go into. Like, as you lose the, I suppose, concrete spirituality, a concrete position for God, you sort of think going back. Now, there's entropy and enthalpy, and a large system which must increase in disorder. In a closed system, must increase in disorder. Obviously, a non-closed system can create order. That is, you can clean up your room, and so you've got a system, and you're putting energy into that system. But a closed system where everything's balanced, and this is the universe, the time has to go forward. So that's interesting. I suppose the pretty amazing concept that time's a dimension. So this starts to unpack some of the things that if you call special relativity Einstein 1.0 and general relativity 2.0, there's an Einstein 0.0. That is the fact that things travel at the speed of light, and what you see, you are your the sense of now is sort of on the bridge of your nose, and whatever you see is in the past. So your feet are 3 nanoseconds in the past. I can see out here to a fence, and that's, say, 10 nanoseconds in the past. Oh, it's probably more than that. I can see to America, and that's a millisecond in the past, you know, a million times the distance of that. And then to the moon, it's a second in the past, and the sunlight is streaming me, that's 8 minutes in the past, or it's now has it's now, which I'm sensing, is 8 minutes ago. It's a sort of bit hard to describe, but so that's Einstein's 0.0, is that where you are, you look into your past, and off, almost Einstein 1.0 is sort of like the kindergarten Einstein. Einstein 2.0, or the expansion of the universe, coming along, that is that. So in special relativity and... There is no mass, well, there's no gravitational, accelerational field, and essentially the same box of space can be distorted, and it's a very, very first order thing. Now, the interesting thing is that if you look out into space, the further you look out, because space is expanding, more time is being placed into space, and so... your space has been stretched out, so time is slowing down. So if a clock is coming towards, if I have a clock on my wrist and I hold it away from myself, that clock is three nanoseconds slow. So this is Einstein 0.0 is 3 nanoseconds slow. If it comes right up to my eyeball, it's on time. And then when I push it further away, it goes back into the past. So your hand at the end of your arm is back in the past. I wouldn't get too excited by all this, because once you understand a certain amount of things, it goes across. What's happening is, as you move your wrist away from you, it's red shifting. And as it's moving towards you, it's blue shifting. And blue shifting means it's ticking more quickly. And so it redshifts, and then it stays, it no longer shifts. Now, what's happening is that means that the stuff that we see on the edge of the universe is ticking more slowly due to blue shifting, due to redshifting. So I think it's a factor of 6. So basically a day... If I watch if I was watching a reality show from the beginning of time, as I can see it, say if someone miraculously gathered together, scooped together all this luscious, yumptious space. So space at 30,000 years after the Big Bang was a nice soup, a beautiful, smooth soup. If it was a cocktail, you wouldn't be able to, no graininess, it would be a beautiful wine. That's right. I don't know if I've had some pretty crap wine, some pretty crap home brew, and it's rough. And it's rough because there's yes, you can taste the alcohol, yes, but you can also taste some other chemicals. Sure, that tastes like ketone, something. It tastes like chemical. You can smell acetones. That's not so much the problem. It's when the brew that you're given has actually got grit in it. That's when it's pretty rough. You know, people get off their face on this type of stuff. But that's the sort of the edge of the universe you're going across. And so I suppose as your knowledge expands, you go for every new thing you know, there's a certain amount of mystery chopped down, and it's just the quality of the next new things you don't know isn't quite as expansive. I can't quite do across. It's sort of like, say, that dark matter and dark energy is an accounting issue. I don't know, I have been so wrong in the bets that I've had the confusion that I've had, I've thought that it might be black holes in the centre of the Earth, sort of microscopic, some sort of, and there could be, the equations for what's going on in the centre of the Earth, the primordial, the generation of magnetic field is hard to understand. The energy comes from something, from some heat, but it's so much energy to make the magnetic fields, and the magnetic fields flipping and orienting. It's hard to understand, but as you're going through. Sir Einstein 0.0 means that you see things at red shifts, and basically as your granny walks away from you, she walks and becomes more youthful, but she's walking into the past, and as she's walking to the past, it's only that her clock is slowing down as she walks away from you, and she will walk away to the end of the room, and she will look a bit more youthful. And you say, "Oh, you're not so bad, Granny. Come close." And as she walks close to you, her clock accelerates, and she goes there. And then this is nothing to do with special relativity. This is not the four-dimensional idea that space is that time is complex. And this is sort of hard to see, and people, it's interesting the way they teach it in school, in terms of they teach not non-matrix things, and there's this beautiful time in mathematics before we went quantum mechanical and matrices. Matrices are so mind-bogglingly, you can have an 15 by 16 by 16 matrix to sort of describe space, and that's enough to drive you absolutely conquers. And this is just one point in space, let alone, you know, it's not calculating the number of people coming into a ground or something like that. So you really needed, for matrices to sit nicely, you needed two things to attack matrices. You needed group theory, or you needed computers, or you needed a combination of both. And so group theory is really Clayton's, how you have a matrix without really talking about a matrix. You can say basically it's sort of like inviting the people you like to a party. To make it a very cool party, you don't invite church people to a really cool drinking party. Similarly, in matrix mechanics, you're limited by a certain number of matrices which can work rather well, and you get this sort of is there anything deeper in it, in terms of the deepness determines the type of matrices that you can use. And the type of matrices that you can use has a name, and then we name that nature to it, but it doesn't actually ever get any further. Then you've got special relativity, which is Einstein 1.0. And this is XYZIT. So that when you take the square of that unit to find a distance, an absolute distance between two points, and that sort of comes a little bit along quantum mechanics, you're subtracting time. So anything so far from me in XYZ is to be instantaneously with me is minus your time. Time when you go to find the actual physical distance. So if I've got a box X, Y, Z, the actual distance from one apex to the alternative thing is the squares, is your two, your double Pythagoras. You do Pythagoras in one thing to get a diagonal, and then if you've got an orthogonal something, a different dimension which doesn't impact the dimension before, you you square it, so it's x squared plus y squared plus z squared will get you a distance in time, but it's x squared plus y squared plus z squared, that's the difference, minus the difference of time will give you the sort of space-time time difference to get that. I suppose the big stories there is how this is related to electromagnetic radiation. So the important thing is that the key things which are frame independent, speed independent, is the potentials. So essentially, if I have a voltmeter on an A cell battery, it will measure. It will read 1.5 volts if you're lucky, but it will read 1.5 volts. In a black hole, it will be 1.45 volts. In all these different scenarios, it will read a voltage there. And similarly, if you had some mechanism, I'll be amazed if you can divide a mechanism, because one of the things is that the voltmeter is measuring a scalar, and so it can actually transmit a scalar down some wires. I don't know whether you can transmit a vector potential, but the vector potential should be the same for all frames. But this is not true for electric field and magnetic field. So electric fields turn into magnetic fields as you speed up, and it does so in sort of almost a predictable way to go across. So one of the things, so we've got several laws. You've got Faraday's law, you've got Gauss's law, which is the flux out of a bag, so your leaky bag, if it's leaking something, it's got stuff in it, and the direction of leak. Or it's got no there's no leaky bowl bags in the monopole. So sort of it's allowed you to go across that direction. You've got Faraday's law of induction plus Ampere's law of magnetic field plus Ampere's law of magnetic field plus Maxwell's law of electric induction. So magnetic induction, you all know, you've got your standard coil and the magnetic flux in the center varies with time. Same thing happens, and that produces a spinning electric field, a hoop electric field, and you can take as much energy out of it's sort of like, this is, if I can have a particle and I put it in an electric field, it will speed up to as much as you want. And of course, as it speeds up, undoes the electric field, the magnetic field there. So you can only take the amount of energy that you put in. However, you can speed it up. And the way we do that, to get it to spin round and round an infinite number of times, we have a number of wires going around. So that's Faraday's field. But there's a sort of equivalent thing in Maxwell's Maxwell's law of electric induction creates a magnetic circular field. So if there was a monopole or something like that, it would go around here. So in the Maxwell's fourth equation, there are two things that the the loop magnetic field, the strength of the magnetic field in a induced the curl or something. Oh god! I'm going to kill this mosquito. There will increase. This is the fourth field. You've got the curl of B, which is really the curl of B. It's how much the B is beginning to curl, and you can see that by doing the loop integral. So the loop integral of B. So it's the amount of B. So if B goes around, if you have a line of force and it goes in a circle, you can get an infinite amount of energy of that, because you just put a particle in that and that will go around and around. Unfortunately, when that particle goes around, in order to stop that happening, it itself is a current and it induces something which sucks away from it. So energy is conserved. But look, the important thing here, and so you got Ampere's law and the generation of force between them. Now, Ampere's law and forces, I suppose, that's one of the things that I was wondering. You think you don't get necessarily a force straight out of Maxwell's equation. However, let's look at Ampere's law. So Ampere's law basically says that if I get a wire, I put a current through it, I generate a magnetic field from it. The current generates a magnetic field. And then if I put a wire with a current in a magnetic field, it generates a force. So one wire will create a force on a second wire. But another way of looking at that is that if you move into a travelling frame and actually travel at the speed of the current in the wire, so I've got some wire, I put some current through it, and the electrons travel at a certain speed. If I go into that frame, I look at the frame above, and there's a relative length contraction of the positive charges, which are now appearing to move, because I've now moved into a moving frame, and the current is staying the same. So I see a relative contraction. And so it looks as though, on the travelling frame, that there is a charge build-up. I've got electrons here, my electrons are here, and there is a charge build-up. So if you've got two currents travelling together, they will pull together. And so there's that that aspect of it. And it sort of is this fundamental thing, which is eventually leads you to, I suppose, a sort of claustrophobia in terms of that there's like a pixel size for the universe and a transformation pairs to the universe, and you cannot beat causality, the flow of time or energy, no matter how much you think and do it. And in order to do that, you have these beautiful contractions, and so really the light's almost a necessity of it. Now, the more disturbing things of it is that the construction of stationarized moving particles. So a particle that I can pick up is obviously stationary. It's got mass, it's got energy, and then if I really hit it really hard if I got all the neutrons and protons together and I said, well, end of the day, guys, you've got to herd up, you've got to not do social distancing, you come together, they would decay and release energy, and I could convert a lot of that mass into energy there. Now, there is this thing which requires a heap of understanding, so I still don't understand it, but it is all pervasive, and this is rotation. So everything has every fundamental particle, which is a fermion, every fundamental thing which exists it has got a projection of H bar on 2. So its angular momentum is more than that, but its final projection, the measurable projection, is H bar on 2. This is the Z components of its angular momentum is there. And that means that it's got a remnant, a memory of frame independence, a rotational frame independence, is stored in its magnetic field. So even though that's a bit of a mystery to it, and you get these things which are physically mind-boggling, that I can get two equations and I can two matrices and I can multiply them together and get zero, and then I can get two particles represented by matrices which can have a matrix representation, and I can put them right through each other as if, so as far as they're concerned, they're zero to each other. And so, and I can, on the page, I can square matrices independently and see them independent. So I can see one cup and two cups, and I can actually, and if they were matrices orthogonal, I could actually push them through each other in space. And like, I do that all the time with particles. I don't do it with cups, because it's with a cup's got too much to, you know, there has to be a collision there, but individual electrons I can push this through. And so you've got this granularity of the universe, of Planck's constant, the Planck's length. We've got the universe, all universe is made up of the same universe space, so the speed of light is constant right throughout the universe. You get these sort of artifacts of moving across. You can understand general relativity, but general relativity is just to do with the tense or complex maths of space. The special relativity, by the time you eat away with a proper treatment of relativity before it, it's not saying, special relativity is not saying all that much. It is a clanger if you don't explain relativity 0.0. 1.0 seems absolutely incredible, but that's more of a indictment on the average teacher coming in with what is truly a medieval absolute clock view of things. And ultimately, if people go in the absolute clock, so St. Thomas Aquinas correctly came up with a formulation of time. This is sort of it's fairly interesting. Called angelic time, which is an absolute clock thing, it's almost impossible to understand. Like it's almost impossible to say to unwork what Bohr. And Summerfield and the people who are doing the neoclassical pre-quantum mechanics stuff in the golden age before quantum mechanics began, it's sort of like basically it's sort of like a constant bonnet drama, like you're reading stuff like that, and then people say, oh, is that scientist of a good fortune, and you almost won't expect to see Pemberley and all that type of stuff going through. The way people describe it, they're really caught up in a bonnet drama, and they don't know it's a period drama. And when you fundamentally come in, there was the statement that by scientists, and obviously scientists, I think perhaps the only people who really believed they knew what they're talking about was Bohr himself. I think Bohr had the impression he knew what he's doing about, and his intellect just was the intellect at the time. It just ran short of it. He ultimately couldn't, there's nothing magical about them. He couldn't understand a situation from beyond himself. So this rotation of the universe and stuff, there is some interest in it, in that finally the realization, and this is sort of like this is weird realization. So from 1922 to 1923-24, they realized the Bohr atom was defunct and that the electron did not orbit the nucleus. Yet it did show evidence of some form of orbiting, and which that was described as spins. So quantum mechanics in that next age is that uneasy stuff. Before it was connected to the universe at large, there was this thing of saying, well, there's some of this magical it's called hidden dimensions, or dimensions we will never understand. And what's happened is that people from the outside have looked at these people who are making these grand statements like, boy, I understand, I have a model, it will work. And the people at the time, with saying no disrespect, we're going to start looking elsewhere. It's, you mightn't see a problem with your argument. It's sort of like I had a child who just snuck out of the room at Easter and came back with chocolate all over their face. And then the thing was, I did Easter eggs. You didn't see me do it, so how do you know? And then they run away, and then they fall asleep on the chair. That type of within their own within Bohr's own world, he thought he understood. So there are these big mysteries to understand. I don't know whether we can. There's certain things that we have sort of S2 symmetry is in nature all around us. Very few people see it. But when you do see it, it's sort of profound and it's there. So that being said, I have these, it's hard to say, it's sort of at my sort of shelf full of, I don't know, things I want to believe or want to understand. I sort of, things I do understand, I remove it, and things I replace up there are not as, I don't know if it's an old, being old, are not as compelling. So I just hope my computer has de-virused itself by now. But it's not as compelling, and being not as compelling, there's that feeling of I suppose knowing the size of the universe, knowing some of the structures of the universe, knowing the structure of stars and things like that. And so my compulsion, the things that really grab my attention now, is trying to really understand the generation of light, the retarded potential. I sort of understand the A vectors, it's just trying to get that in, trying to really understand it. Trying to understand the rotational dimension frozen in the universe in some sort of physical way, which what all the matter that we see is stopped rotating, it's got a rotational absolute. There is, we don't have an absolute origin center of the universe. Every place you go, wherever you walk, you're always the center of your universe, your perception of the universe. But there is an absolute rotational origin, and then with respect to that, it's come across, and this is very necessary for light to come, for light to emit. Light, as it emits, has a little kickback, and you put a little kick into the universe, and then the universe puts a little kick into you and absorb light. It's like that. It's a wonder whether you could possibly get the universe to spin up if you had enough light going through. So look, on this I'll stop, and I'll go through and check on my computer. to upload the latest thing. Thanks a lot for listening. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.